our main guest tonight, which to me, it's like, this is really exciting because this is somebody that I've been following for a really long time. Norman Finkelstein is a political scientist, an activist, an academic, a scholar, and somebody who is spent a very huge majority of his time focused on Israel and Palestine and issues. And he is also a child of Holocaust survivors, which I think creates a very unique lens, which is why when he also, such as myself, I know has probably been referred to as a self-loathing Jew. And so, and all of the things, because everything, of course, Judaism is now Zionism, and we're all mixed together. So without any further ado, and we're going to touch on a lot of issues. I mean, there's a lot of things I really want to talk about, but let's go.
Well, I think the most important thing about Mr. Finkelstein is the fact that he did work at Rutgers University. I mean, for me, that's everything.
Oh, for God's sake.
I'm a Scarlet.
So oh, good funny. God.
Good evening, Norman. Thank you for coming on. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is really a very good opportunity. You're someone that I've been following and reading for a long time. And I have recently, as a Jewish person, really had this more, I'm like getting lefter and lefter. And so the timing of you coming on is really good. I'm sort of having like my coming out as, you know, really not supportive of an ethno state in general. But if you could talk a little bit about what we're seeing right now with the shift, let's start with current events. And, you know, obviously Netanyahu has finally been ousted. But then what's coming up is not necessarily a treat. So would you talk a little bit about what we're seeing right now, what's current, just because it just happened?
Well, I would say that there has been a revealing shift in public opinion. I don't think, because I don't believe in miracles, I don't think it's something that happened overnight. I think during the last Israeli assault on Gaza, it was a kind of, to use the cliches, there was a tipping point, there was a critical mass had been reached, and this accumulation of murderous assaults on the Palestinians, 2008-09 Operation Cast Lead, 2012 Operation Pillar of Defense, 2014 Operation Protective Edge. Then there was the Great March of Return in Gaza and the Israeli snipers shooting down overwhelmingly nonviolent civil resistors. And then there was the most recent assault on Gaza. And then that's all in the context, the overall context, of Gaza having been hermetically sealed since 2006 in this medieval siege where 1 million children, the population of Gaza is about 2,100,000. Of that population, more than 50% are children. They are under the age of 18. 70% are refugees or sons and daughters of refugees from the 1948 war. So you have an overwhelmingly refugee population, a majority child population, which has been sealed in an open air prison.
Yeah.
What some Israelis call, without being in any way indifferent to the resonance of the language, they call it a concentration camp. Israel's leading sociologist, until he passed, Baruch Kimmerling, he described Gaza as the largest concentration camp ever. And he said that way back in 2003, before the siege of Gaza had begun. So there is the context, then there are the punctuating assaults on Gaza, and people took it in, and I think a critical mass was reached in May 10th, when the most recent Israeli murderous assault on Gaza began. And then there was then two other, what you might call, circumstantial factors. Factor number one, and refers to an expression you used a moment ago where you said, I'm having trouble with the idea of an ethno-state. And that to me is not so much a revealing remark as an indicative remark, indicative of the heightened sensitivity, in particular of your generation, that came about due to the Black Lives Matter movement. So there was now a heightened sensitivity to white supremacy, white domination, racism, and so forth. And just as this heightened sensitivity crystallized in your generation in particular, at the same time, Israel's leading human rights organization for the occupied Palestinian territories, it's called B'Tselem, it came out with a position paper stating that not just the occupied territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, but Israel itself, the position paper said Israel is a Jewish supremacist state that practices apartheid. So in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement and the heightened sensitivity to issues of racial supremacy and racial domination, along comes Israel's most respected human rights organization. And it says that whole area from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, inclusive of the state of Israel, is a Jewish supremacist state practicing apartheid. And then at the same time, the leading human rights organization in the world, Human Rights Watch, it comes out with a report, substantial report, 210 pages, very heavily footnoted, very scholarly. And it states that Israel is based, the whole area, including Israel itself, not just the occupied territories, it says Israel is a state based on Jewish domination, and it's practicing apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territories. So within the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, those were explosive, and I do think explosive is the correct word, those were explosive statements by these leading human rights organizations. And then, as I said, there's the longer historical context of an overwhelmingly refugee child population caught in, trapped in this medieval siege, and then punctuated this siege by periodic Israeli massacres on a very large scale in Gaza. So if you put the whole picture together, I would say probably the correct expression would be it had reached a critical mass. And so it was kind of spectacular. You folks are obviously much too young to remember.
I love that you put us together as young together, because we're really not, like, he's a different generation than me. I'm older.
Yeah, but you're both, I think, separated from me by a chasm. So that's why I put you two together.
She's 50.
I'm 50.
Okay. 50 is, in other
words. Say it. I'm past middle age. You could say it. It's once you're past middle age, you're old.
I was going to say, you must be blessed with a very good climate or diet.
Weed and Pilates.
Okay, I'm a vegetarian, but I don't look like you, so you're very lucky. So, as I said, both of your generation still won't remember, even if you're 50. There was a time when if Israel came under what's called an existential threat, it was being attacked. I'm from New York City. Do you mind if I ask where are you folks from? Is it Florida?
He's from New Jersey.
I'm from Jersey.
I'm a second generation native Jewish Floridian.
Floridian, okay. So you won't find what I'm about to say surprising. There was a time when if Israel said it was under attack, the next day there would be an emergency mobilization in support of Israel, and there would be literally, I'm not using hyperbolic terms now, there would be literally a million people along Fifth Avenue, obviously almost all Jews, in support of Israel. Yeah. And every public official, from the local councilman to the senators in the United States, they would all be out there giving their support for Israel. You may even recall as late as 2014, during Operation Protective Edge, our mayor, meaning New York, our mayor Bloomberg, flew right over to Israel to register his support. Mm. Now, what happened this last time? In the week of May 10th to 20th, there were two tiny, tiny demonstrations, 500 people each, in support of Israel, whereas there were tens and tens and tens of thousands out in New York in support of the Palestinians. I happened to attend both the Black Lives Matter demonstrations every night for 6 weeks, and I attended the demonstrations in support of the Palestinians. It was almost exactly the same age cohort, 20-something. There was not even anyone over 30. I was holding up the fort for everyone from 30 to 200, you know, in these demonstrations. In part, you know, during the George Floyd, it was in part because of COVID. It was only 20-something. But it was breathtaking, because in my day, you got 300 people in support of the Palestinians, literally, because I go back to the 1970s. 30 people in support of the 300 people in support of the Palestinians, and you would have a million people in support of Israel. Now, it was exactly the opposite. And what's even more revealing, Israel's leading supporters in Congress, Chuck Schumer, Gerald Nadler, Bob Menendez, none of them said a word in support of Israel. It's changing.
I wanted to talk with you about something that I've been thinking, and this is sort of like my attempt at some sort of academic concept about this, but my parents were raised in this very post-Holocaust PTSD from their parents' mindset. Mm-hmm. My mom always says, you know, she was born in 48. She shares the birth year of Israel. She grew up, everything was about Israel. Everything. Like we were trained to basically be Zionists. And there's this whole part of the story that was never taught. It was never taught. We never heard that. It was always a people with no land, or a land with no people, for a people without a land, or whatever they would say. And we were never taught that this, in fact, was basically a genocide of gargantuan proportions. We weren't taught that. You don't learn about the Nakba. We don't learn that in this country. Secular Jews do not learn that story. So it's like a whole re-education process that we have to go through. And these people are very fear-based in their mindset about what happens if there's no Israel, what happens if there's no Jewish state, what'll happen to the Jews. And it's like PTSD is who taught that generation. And I think that we're gonna see that less and less as the boomers are sort of more on their way out. No offense.
I didn't take offense until you said no offense. You remind me, when I jog along the beach, people stop me and say, "You look great for your age."
But can you talk about that? Like how accurate history. We did not learn that.
Well, there are several things to be said. And I have to be careful. You know, I was a professor by training, so it takes us a half hour to clear our throats before we start, you know, the hot air. So I have to be careful. But let me just make a few brief points. There's a kind of optical illusion about the relationship of American Jews to Israel. Between 1948 and 1967, Israel figured barely in the mindset of American Jews. Remember, Israel was a very tiny place. It was very poor, austere, simple life, and it was like a backwater. And after World War II, American Jews are making it in American society. All the kinds of discriminations they suffered, they disappeared. And the doors were now opening. The Jews were entering the professions, and they were succeeding. So they were fully Americanized, and they had very big ambitions. I'll just give you an example. My high school, which was a public high school, Who went to my high school? Charles Schumer went to my high school. Bernie Sanders went to my high school. Judge Judy went to my high school. I'm serious.
Yeah. She went to James Madison, right?
Yes. Carol King went to my high school.
There you go.
These were all people who were very ambitious, lower Jewish middle class. And they were looking to conquer the United States, which was the equivalent of conquering the world. And the truth is, they did. It's extremely impressive what was achieved by that generation. And so they had no interest at all in Israel, except as the occasional object of charity. You gave some money to plant a tree in Israel. That was the sort of stuff. Very few American Jews visited Israel during that period. In addition, it will surprise you to learn, I think, that very few American Jews had any interest at all. Now, I know this will shock you. They had very little interest at all in the Nazi Holocaust. It simply didn't come up. You have to remember, now I'll say it again, you both of you are too young to remember. Back in that era, the Nazi Holocaust was not an object of pity. It was for Jews. I know this will shock you, so brace yourself. It was for Jews an object of shame. You see, it was said the Jews went like sheep to slaughter. That was the description. My parents are true survivors. I have to always say that because there came a point where everybody was going around saying, I was a Holocaust survivor. I was a Holocaust survivor. Every two out of three Jews you would cross, meet in the street, I was a Holocaust survivor. They were not.
They left. Their families left.
They got out in various ways. A large number of them, when Poland was divided in 1939, they went to the Russian side. They escaped that way. Others, like you said, they got out earlier, like Henry Kissinger, you know, 1935, 1936, they get out when they see what's coming. My parents were among the few actual survivors. The numbers given are like in 1945, about 100,000 Jews survived either the ghettos, the concentration camps, or the death camps. Either the ghettos, the concentration camps, or the labor camps. And most of those who survived were in all three. My mother and father, may they rest in peace, they were in the Warsaw ghetto. They were then in Majdanek concentration camp. My father ended up in Auschwitz concentration camp. My mother ended up in two slave labor camps. So they were the real deal. As my mother would say, the real McCoy. They were in the Nazi Holocaust. Why do I mention all this? I mention it for the following reason. Because as I've already indicated to you, not because I was smart, but because I was smart enough to want to be among the smart crowd. I hung out with very smart, high achievers, high achievers. And remember, I grew up in the 60s. Politics were all around you. the war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement. Politics was in the air. The air was saturated with politics. Now, here's the kicker. I could say without fear of contradiction, you can even put a polygraph to my wrist right now, and I do not fear saying, in my whole childhood, I do not remember one friend, not one friend or parent of a friend, who ever asked me a single question about what happened to my parents. They knew that they had been in the Nazi Holocaust. My father had a tattoo. Auschwitz was the only camp that issued a tattoo. And my father had a tattoo from Auschwitz. Nobody had any interest in it. It's the kind of, as I said, an optical illusion. You assume, and your mother tells you, we were all, you know, concerned about Israel, concerned about the Holocaust. It's not true. The only book we read in school, the only book we read in school pertaining to the Nazi Holocaust was in seventh grade, we read Anne Frank's diary.
Yeah.
And even Anne Frank's diary, it was not taught as a Jewish tragedy. The Jewish element was completely eliminated. It was taught as a human tragedy. The Jewish part was just taken out. So I think we have to, there's a famous Hungarian Marxist, his name was George Lukács, and Lukács once wrote that we have to always see the present as history. I think it's a useful observation that we shouldn't assume that what we see at present always was. Yes, it's true. Now there is, certainly for your parents' generation, a very heightened sensitivity to the fragility of the state of Israel and the Nazi Holocaust. But that's all pretty recent. It happened after the 1967 war, after the June war, which I'm not going to go into now. But I would also say two other things in response to your question. I know this is about a kind of circumlocution or a digression, really. When I was growing up, the only thing we learned about American history regarding the Native Americans was that they were savages.
Right.
I vividly remember, it's not a source of pride to me, but it's worth acknowledging for your generation. I remember watching the cowboy and Indian programs, the TV shows and movies, and I'm rooting for them. Kill those savages, kill those savages. I mean, I was like kind of mad, but they built up, you know, they built up that lunacy in the viewer. I remember, I know it's gonna sound hilarious to you, how pained and anguished and tormented I was when I watched Remember the Alamo. It was a famous Walt Disney film. The Alamo was where Davy Crockett died, Lieutenant Rip Travers.
I lived in San Antonio for 6 years. Okay. I'm extremely familiar with the Alamo. Okay. Very familiar.
I remember
with
the Alamo. I was there once.
everybody who ever came to visit, I got to go to the Alamo.
Okay, so you're on the same page as me, as your generation puts it. I didn't know until probably I was in my 30s that the United States stole Texas. I hated Lieutenant Santa Anna. I wanted to kill Lieutenant Santa Anna
because
he defeated the defenders of the Alamo. It wasn't until, believe it or not, it wasn't until 1975 that Hollywood made its first film sympathetic to Native Americans. It was with Dustin Hoffman. It was called Little Big Men.
Yeah.
That was the first film. So when you talk about our, meaning American Jewish, brainwashing about Israel, there's also the American brainwashing, which is roughly the same time, about our own history.
Right.
It was completely suppressed. Completely suppressed.
Yeah, we had Margaret Kimberly on Memorial Day, and we talked about the Tulsa massacre, which I was never taught in school. I never got taught that. Largest race massacre in the history of the country, and we're not taught that.
Yeah, so I don't want to... Israel should be held culpable and responsible for all of its crimes, its ongoing crimes. But we should not be put ourselves in the position of forgetting our own history and forgetting just how recent is our own understanding and knowledge of what was done here. And not so long ago, not so long ago, the textbooks. I remember, I know you'll find these things because I am old. And so I'm talking about a long time ago, but I distinctly remember as late as sophomore year in high school, my history teacher was named Mr. Storch, a smart guy. He went to Columbia. At that point, New York City, the highest paid civil service job was teachers. And so teachers were both respected and deserving of respect because they were smart. They were paid very well. Now teachers, you know, they're below fire department, below police, below sanitation. But back then they attracted a very impressive group of faculty. In any event, I remember Mr. Storch saying, he said, slavery wasn't so bad. He said, because slaves were expensive property. And just as if you purchased a new car, you wouldn't take a hammer to damage the car that you just purchased, slaves were also very expensive. So obviously, so the logic went, the slaves were treated very well by their masters. Hey, I was in the advanced history class. It was AP history. And back then, AP was something unusual. Now it became, everything is AP. I was in the top class. History was my, so to speak, forte. And the best teacher. But that's what we were taught. That's what we were taught. So I can't express shock at the ignorance of American Jews about Israeli history, and also the fact that Israel has a very effective propaganda apparatus, PR machine. We had our effective propaganda apparatus. It was called public education.
Yeah, let me ask you, let's talk a little bit about BDS, because this is something that I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about it. I mean, in general, I support anybody's right to use their money or not use their money. Like, I'm obviously very opposed to anti-BDS legislation, but I have some concerns about it as a movement. And I know that I had read that you were not necessarily supportive of it as well. And I'm curious why. Like, I'm curious, what is your position on BDS and why? And I'm sincerely asking, like, yeah, it's not like baiting.
Yeah, look. You assume in any conversation, you try to assume good faith. I get a lot of correspondence every day. And my mentor in life, as a factual matter, it's not a boast, but I want to acknowledge it, for 40 years was Professor Chomsky. And one of the things about Chomsky, Professor Chomsky, is he answers every email. He spent probably, there were days he spent in a week, he would spend certain days, maybe 8 hours answering email. It was breathtaking, to tell you the truth. And so I answer all emails, and I try to assume good faith. Now, sometimes as the correspondence unfolds, you see there's not good faith here. There's just a person who is, whether you call it, your generation calls it trolling.
Yeah.
So then at some point you have the right, the moral right, to say, you know what, I'm not continuing this because you're not serious. So I try to assume good faith, and I assume the good faith of your question. If I discover otherwise, then I have the right, as I say, to turn, you know, to switch you off. But until that happens, I'm going to assume good faith. And I'm going to try to give you a good faith answer, although it may not resonate for all of your listeners, or even for many of your listeners. I was for a long time, a significant period of my life, maybe not in actual time span, but in terms of my own intellectual and political coming of age, I was a Maoist, a follower of Chairman Mao. We were Mao Zedong, live like him, dare to struggle, dare to win. You know, I was very fervent, you could say, with a certain amount of fairness, you could say fanatical. And once I passed that phase in my life, I was very cautious of cults, of sloganeering, of blind following. And also, I became very cautious of posturing, the radical posturing and posing and trying to appear radical, as against trying to get things done. I deeply regret that in those years, I could have been what was called back then a Nader Raider, a follower of Ralph Nader, working in Congress and getting things done. Airbags in cars, seat belts in cars. I mean, we're talking about saving millions of lives. It's probably true to say that Ralph Nader is responsible for saving more American lives than any other single individual in the United States. I didn't take that route. I took the route of socialist revolution, dictatorship of the proletariat, armed resistance. And I have to say, it's not an easy admission, but I have to say I was a fool. Last night I was reading Jimmy Carter, I have it right here. I was reading Jimmy Carter's memoir of his years in the White House, Keeping Faith. And he was the one, it was during his administration that relations were normalized between the United States and China. And he describes the conversations between him and the person who was the new leader of China after Mao Zedong's passing. His name was Deng Xiaoping. And I saw how cynical the Chinese leaders were. Had I read that when it came out, I would have said, oh, it's all bourgeois propaganda. Carter saying that Deng Xiaoping said these things, but he didn't. Well, you know what? He said them, and I was a fool. And so I developed a real aversion to slogans, cults,
groupthink.
And it's my opinion that BDS is a movement which doesn't analyze, doesn't try to figure out what's happening now, what are the balance of forces, what's possible, what's not possible, what's realizable, what's not realizable. It's just one slogan, BDS, BDS, BDS. And I don't believe that there is much substance behind the slogan. And I also don't believe that it's really a movement. It's a lot of celebrities. It became like BDS became like there was BDS and BLM. boycott, divestment, sanctions, and Black Lives Matter. And then quickly, what did you discover with Black Lives Matter? Well, a lot of Black Lives Matter, one has to say, it was a sham. It was Patrice Cullors, Tamika Mallory, Sean King, cashing in really quite spectacular amounts of money. Black Lives Matter took in this past year, according to their own official announcement, $90 million. And everybody in the grassroots is wondering, where did the money go?
Yeah.
And Patrice Cullors, you know, a classic case of take the money and run. After all the exposés, so 2 weeks ago, she announces, I'm leaving, I'm out of here, you know? So you have to, in my opinion, having been involved in politics for a very long time, you have to always be a little bit suspicious of any movement which becomes too popular too fast.
Yes.
And too many chic people embracing it.
Yeah.
So I have specific criticisms of Black Lives Matter, which I've expressed in many occasions. Excuse me, I have specific criticisms of BDS, which I've expressed on many occasions. And I wouldn't want to squander time by repeating to you what people can find in the web in 100 or 1,000.
Yeah. No, I was just wanting to know what your general mindset was on it.
In general, as you say, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, those are completely legitimate tactics. And they are quite often effective tactics. But still, one has to, in my opinion, one has to do careful analysis of what's possible, what's not possible, and also to be open to the fact that reasonable people, and I'd like to underline this point, reasonable people can disagree. So I'll give you an example from the 1980s. As you know, there was an international anti-apartheid movement, which included the sanctions movement. And it also included the cultural boycott of South Africa. Now, some people broke the cultural boycott, and they were really wretched, mercenary scum. And I had no problem denouncing them as such. But then there were gray areas. So the most famous of the gray areas was Paul Simon, of Simon and Garfunkel.
I'm old enough. I know Paul Simon.
Right, right.
Even he knows Paul Simon, but I know Paul Simon.
So Paul Simon went to South Africa.
Let me do this.
And he formed a band with South African musicians. Some people attacked him mercilessly for breaking the cultural boycott. Other people said he was bringing the humanity of South African musicians and artists. He was using his name to spread their humanity around the world. He had, you can Google it if you're in front of a computer, Paul Simon, his band. And so I say, reasonable people can disagree about these things. You don't automatically deserve a pariah's status if you have a different judgment on this particular case. In some cases, I'll be honest, I won't accept a differing judgment. I would just say you're just being selfish, self-centered. You know, you take an example. If you look at during the civil rights movement in the United States, so there were occasions where in the cities, the smaller cities, in Tennessee, they would organize boycotts of the downtown area. where all the white businesses were. They would organize, the civil rights agitators would organize boycotts of the stores because they wouldn't desegregate, okay? Or they had various segregationist facilities in place. And let's say with the organized boycott on Easter week, which is where African Americans would spend a lot of money. And there were some African Americans who would break the boycott. And the folks in this, the organizers would say, we would go downtown and we would grab their packages as they're walking out of the store and, you know, send the message, you better not break the boycott. There I have no problem. I don't feel it's a gray area issue. It's somebody just being selfish. But I don't think Paul Simon was just being selfish. I think he had a different judgment that he could actually do something good for South Africa by going there, establishing a band, and so forth. So you mentioned in your introductory remark, you mentioned the group thing. And yes, I do have a problem when people don't allow for the fact that others can, in good faith, have a different judgment.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what that looks like in academia, because something that I've noticed, and obviously you know very well, is that academicians that have a particular stance that's not particularly pro-Israel get treated a certain way by a lot of our higher institutions in this country. And it is pretty pervasive. It's something we just saw Dr. Cornel West just had this going on that he just went through. And I know this is something that you've been through as well. Can you talk a little bit about how the powers that be really stifle any sort of support for Palestinians in the academic circles?
I want to say, I kind of think it's a mixed picture. First of all, I want to say I want to give both sides, because I think the picture is slightly more complicated than the black and white that it's often depicted as. In college campuses and in college campuses, universities, Israel has lost the battle for public opinion. It's very difficult in a college campus at a university to defend Israel's policies. They have no support anymore. If, let's say, the Hillel, the Jewish social organization, which is basically a front for Israel, if Hillel organizes an event, if it organizes an event, let's say an IDF, an Israeli soldier, is going to come speak, they may get 50 people. If Palestinians organize an event, they can get 500 people. So Israel has lost the battle for public opinion on virtually all college campuses and universities in the United States. In addition, the professional associations, like the Middle East Studies Association, MESA, they're all totally pro-Palestinian. In fact, the Israeli supporters backed out of these organizations and formed this thing called Israel Studies. They formed Israel Studies because they lost the battle in the professional associations. So I don't think it's correct to say that academia is anti-Palestinian. What I do think is correct to say is that when Jews lost the battle for public opinion on college campuses, what they did was they started to act behind the scenes. They had alumni call up and say, we're not going to give you any more contributions if you hire this person. They had organizations imposing a lot of force, exerting a lot of force in those administrations to curb the pro-Palestinian sentiment on campus. I fell victim in part. I fell victim to Professor Dershowitz's jihad against me, but also the university, which was an utterly ninth-rate university, DePaul University. It was in Chicago. It was always expanding its real estate holdings, and Chicago has a very powerful Jewish, wealthy constituency, and also in real estate. So all sorts of pressures are applied through the Board of Trustees to the university administration. You got to get rid of this guy. You got to get rid of this guy, you know? So that's where I think the problem lies. In public opinion, they've lost. But in terms of the administration, the Board of Trustees, it's a problem because Jews are the wealthiest ethno-religious group in the United States. They also tend to be liberal. So go to a library where they have the list of people who contributed to the library. Always a lot of Jewish names.
Yeah.
Go to a hospital. Look at the names of buildings in a university. How many of the names now are Jewish? So, very wealthy group, and also a group that contributes a lot of money to public institutions and public causes. So that's a lot of money to lose. It's a lot of money to lose if you hire someone like me.
Right.
That's where I think the problem is. So I think it's a mixed picture.
So what you're saying is the general attitude on university campuses is more left and more, Palestinian, absolutely. which I understand. I was just talking in terms of the ability of somebody to get tenure when they've spoken out against the state of Israel is seemingly very challenging.
Yeah, no, I only mention it because when I first started out in academia, everybody was terrified of the Jewish organizations. You couldn't say a word on campus. I remember I had classes, I was teaching at Brooklyn College. I know these things are hard to believe and impossible at this point in my life to document. I would sit in a class and there would be two students from the campus Hillel sitting in the first row and talking to each other loudly while I'm trying to teach. I would tell them to stop, they wouldn't stop. I would tell them to stop again, they wouldn't stop. I would tell them to leave the room, they would not leave the room. Everybody else in the class is just terrified, terrified. I go down to complain to my chair, Martin Berkowitz, won't do anything. That's what it was like back then. That's what it was like in 1990. When I started teaching, 1988, when I started teaching. Now that's unthinkable. That can never happen now. Absolutely impossible. It would be the Jewish students who would be a little bit cautious about what they say, So that changed. But then what happened was they started to use strong arm tactics, the Jewish organizations behind the scenes.
Right.
Norman, I've been obviously letting you and Jen, have, because this is more your...
He thinks it's tribal, thing. But he's Jewish. No, he doesn't want to acknowledge it, but he had his little bar mitzvah.
Do me a favor. Just,
okay.
Jen likes to mother me sometimes and it gets annoying. So. But I think it's important to talk about a couple of things. You bring up academia and the issues that exist. I think Alan Dershowitz is emblematic of a lot of the problems that do exist within this, what I would call somewhat of a protected class. he has a lot of dirt under his fingernails, and he's been able to skate for a very long time. But he is one of the most avid Zionists we have in this country. And I'm curious how this, you know, relates to sort of this protected class that as long as you are pro-Israel, you are basically able to get away with what you're going to get away with. And then I think a second follow-up to that, which we can also get into, is the power of the evangelical right and the role that they play in sort of this Teflon approach to Israel in our country.
Alan Dershowitz is an interesting case because he did many things which by any elementary moral standard are really despicable. Among them were his consistent, persistent lying about what Israel was or wasn't doing in its relationship to the Palestinians. And what to me is interesting, you see, obviously I know a lot about Professor Dershowitz because our paths crossed, and unfortunately it wasn't just ships passing in the night. Our paths crossed for a sustained period of time, by the end of which in 2007 he had successfully made me not just unemployed, but was a separate category, unemployable. So I never worked again after 2007. I was in the midpoint of my career, of what should have been the midpoint of my career. Because I was a Maoist, I didn't get started until 1988 as a professor. And then my whole career was over in 2007. So I was just 19 years. And then I couldn't work at all. I'm serious. I know a lot of times I always have to say I'm being literal because the things I say sound kind of hard to conceive. I couldn't get a job as a door catcher after 2007 because of the miracle of Google. Whenever anybody in my day, when you applied for work, you would ask, typically you would be asked to supply three recommendations. By your generation, they didn't ask for recommendations at all. They just checked you out on Google. They just Googled your name. And when you Googled my name, what came up was Holocaust denier, anti-Semite.
Right.
Literally tens of thousands of websites. So, Professor Dershowitz, he had done many despicable things. Let's just take the most basic. There was a long period of time, up until maybe 4 years ago, when Professor Dershowitz was always described as Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard University, famed civil liberties lawyer, That was his descriptive, famed civil liberties lawyer. He wasn't a civil liberties lawyer. There's no truth to that. Alan Dershowitz, his career began in the 1970s, his public career as a public presence, not his professional career. He was a Harvard professor, and I assume he was competent in his field of expertise. But his professional career begins. He was a defender of pornography. That was his big thing, because back then, pornography was considered a civil liberties issue, because it was banned. There was widespread prohibitions. He was the lawyer for I Am Curious Yellow, which was the first pornography film imported to the United States. It was a French film, I Am Curious Yellow. He was the lawyer for Harry Reams when Linda Lovelace,
Deep Throat,
she accused him of Harry Reams of having brutalized her in the filming of Deep Throat. He was the lawyer for Deep Throat. He was then the lawyer for Klaus von Bülow, who was credibly accused of killing his wife. He was the lawyer for the Jewish Defense League when they killed a woman who was the secretary of a fellow named Sal Hurick. He was the lawyer for Mike Tyson. He was the lawyer for O.J. Simpson. He was the lawyer for every high-profile wife batterer, rapist, murderer, or spousal batterer and murderer. He was the lawyer for all of them. That came under the rubric of famed civil liberties lawyer. That's not a civil liberties lawyer. That's not a civil liberty, civil.
It's a criminal defense lawyer.
Right. It's a criminal defense lawyer and a criminal defense lawyer with a red thread running through it. Women who were raped, battered, or murdered. That's his MO. That's Alan Dershowitz. That never did any harm to his reputation. Any harm. If you were to Google now, you know, your listeners can do it on their own. Your viewers can do it on their own. If you were to go now and look at the parade of academics who are celebrating Alan Dershowitz when he is retired or retires from Harvard Law School, it's everybody, a who's who of academia is there. And the Harvard Law School Dean, Martha Minow, she's singing the praises of Alan Dershowitz. She's a famous feminist scholar, a feminist legal scholar, knowing full well his record, singing his praises. And among the other things, that's his public defense activity. Then there is the Israel stuff, the lying in very serious cases of Palestinian detainees who were tortured by Israel. They bring their cases to court because there were deportation cases for them. Israel's trying to deport these detainees who ended up in the United States. And he's lying and saying Israel doesn't practice torture. Where people were facing the prospect of being deported back and being tortured again. And he's lying and lying. What happened to Dershowitz? It's a very interesting thing. It's an interesting thing. He suddenly becomes a pariah, not even over the Jeffrey Epstein case. Not even he was Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer.
Oh, yes. You know, it makes perfect sense. I can see they'd get along swimmingly.
Sure. Of course it makes perfect sense. And as far as I can tell, his accuser, Virginia Giffrey, she's completely credible. And at least the allegations against him. In any event, what happens? Even the Jeffrey Epstein doesn't turn people against him. It was because of Trump. Because he supported Trump, all of a sudden the woke people on Martha's Vineyard turned him into a pariah. Mm-hmm. They didn't care about the Israel stuff. They didn't care about the misogyny. They didn't care about the fact that he got Jeffrey Epstein off. It was even interesting. So Jeffrey Epstein got 1 year, you know, in the first trial, he got 1 year. He was out on his own recognizance all day. He only had to come back, you know, he had his office outside. He only had to come back at night for his sentence. And Dershowitz was asked about it. And he says, do you feel bad in retrospect when, you know, it came out that he had done this and done that and done that? Dershowitz said, feel bad? The only thing I feel bad is that he got 1 year. I think he should have gotten scot-free. Now, he's saying this after all the claims and allegations against Epstein. That didn't alienate anyone. people like, you know, Jeffrey Toobin.
Yes.
Yeah. Toobin is singing his praises. Yeah. And then Toobin has an article. I think it was, I can't remember where the article was. It may have been the New Republic, but don't count me on it. Toobin says, has an article. What happened to Alan Dershowitz? You know, because he's defending Trump now. As if he had a clean slate up until his defense of Trump. And if you ask me, I can't prove it. And when I'm speculating, I want to quickly admit to saying I speculate. If you ask me what happened was, Dershowitz was afraid he was going to be convicted in the Giffrey case, the young woman who says that she had sex with him, non-consensual sex. So he was afraid, so he was defending Trump to get a get-out-jail-free card in case he was convicted. That's all he did. I mean,
he's a snake. He is just such a snake. He even looks like a snake.
But you know what? Here's the thing. You want to know what? In my opinion, they're all snakes.
Mm.
Yes.
Jeffrey Toobin, he's also a snake. They're all snakes. The difference is, for me, Alan Dershowitz, I know you'll laugh. Yeah, so you'll forgive my analogy. Alan Dershowitz, to me, he's like Michael Jackson. He is what he is. Wait,
sorry.
He is what he is. That's who he is. I never really faulted Michael Jackson.
Same.
Michael Jackson, apparently, he had an illness. It was a serious illness. He couldn't control himself. The problem was the enablers.
Yes.
All the people that knew what was happening, but they couldn't resist the money, the celebrity, the connections, and they enabled Michael Jackson. You may not agree with me, but that's how I feel about the parents of those kids. You know? I don't know about your mom and dad, either of you. I don't know about your mom and dad, but I remember Michael Jackson when he came out with the, I forgot the name of the album, but with Beat It. Beat It.
Yeah,
Beat It,
Thriller.
Thriller album, the Thriller album. And when he performed the, when he did the.
It was Billie Jean. It was Billie Jean at the Grammys, right?
Well, it was, whenever he said Beat It, Beat It, Beat It, he was grabbing his crotch.
Oh, right.
Writing, right?
God.
So it was out there, right? It was out there. Now, are you a parent, Jen? Are you a parent?
I am. I am.
Okay. If your kid came over to you and said, Mommy, Mikey wants me to stay over at night, would you let your kids stay over?
No, and of course not. But, you know, this is one of those things where when you say things like that, it's you're blaming the victim. And the thing is, the parents are basically selling their kids.
No, but what are they selling
their kids. So allow me to finish and I'll hear you out. You know, I want to hear you out. So it wasn't Michael Jackson. It was the enablers who didn't suffer from that mental illness, who knew fully well what was going on, and didn't sit down with him and say, Michael, you have an illness. There's a serious problem here. And if you don't turn yourself in, I have to turn you in. Nobody did that. And it was the same thing with Dershowitz. None of them said, you know what, Alan? What you're doing is fucked up. It is serious.
See, Ron, it does.
Excuse me?
I'm teasing. It's a joke.
Go ahead.
It's seriously fucked up. No, but because he was the celebrity lawyer. And so they all kissed his ass. You go see in the YouTube, one panel, five people or six people, second panel, six people, third panel, six people. You'll see Jeffrey Toobin there. You'll see Steve Pinker there. You'll see all the big names in academia and in journalism. They're all there kissing his ass. The enablers, enablers like Elena Kagan, who was the dean at Harvard Law School when I had my troubles with him. And then she went on to become the Supreme Court Justice.
I know.
They are the ones I loathe. Alan Dershowitz is Alan Dershowitz, like Michael Jackson is Michael Jackson.
We're speaking with Norman Finkelstein, author and professor. I am curious because, you know, my awakening moment when it came to, and again, this is a cesspool within, and again, you're in the New York circles and you probably-
I'm not in any circles.
Know people, let's just put it that way. The aha moment for me, more than anything else, was with Polanski, when everybody, you know, knew what he was up to, and then you had Harrison Ford and everybody else coming out saying, oh, he's a good guy, and he's this and that. I'm like, listen, you know that he has been, you know, he has been getting it on with 13, 14-year-old girls for God knows how long. You sweep it under the goddamn rug because you are all benefiting financially from his reputation. And again, who goes and literally who moves to France, which does not have extradition and is never going to leave that country until he dies?
What did Whoopi Goldberg do? When she was asked about it on The View, she said, that's not rape. That's not rape. And then she got called on it. No, look it up. Do you know the story?
No, I avoid The View at all costs.
Now look, I only know it because of the Roman Polanski connection.
Right.
Go watch it.
Yeah.
Because, and then she got called on it. And the next day, she gives this idiotic defense of what she said. It's all, you wash my hand, I wash yours, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And it's also the notion that certain people can't be held to the same rules as everyone else. They're too important. There's the rules for the little guy, and then there are the rules for the important people.
Well, you know, everybody focuses obviously on Weinstein and all the things that he has done. I'm not going to name who has informed me of this, but I know that David Geffen, let's just say that there's not such good things that have been reported about him either.
You're gossiping.
But I'm not gossiping. I'm just not going to say who said it.
Okay.
All I'm saying is, this is the type of stuff that very powerful people are able to get away with.
It was a kind of curiosity, because up until that moment, there must have been 10,000 jokes about what was called the casting couch. And then All of a sudden, everybody is shocked.
Right.
Well, that's like saying Via Zadora was only able to get her roles because she's such a great actress. No, I mean, again, sometimes it's all about who you know. And, well, I'm just using it as an example.
I think that's true. You see, I don't want to get into that because it's
going to
I happen to agree. I agree. No. But the original question you asked with Dershowitz, I'll just repeat my own view. After everything that happened, I'll tell you just a quick story, and then I should get off because I have to do work. Right?
Yeah.
About 5 years ago, I was at our Indian restaurant on the Upper East Side. A friend took me out, and Alan Dershowitz was there in the restaurant.
Stop it.
And he was. When he obviously saw me before I saw him, and he was covering his face like this. And so then the friend of mine who I was sitting with, he said to me, how about we invite him over to our table? Stop. And I had very, very mixed feelings, conflicted feelings, not mixed, very conflicted feelings, because during my tenure case, he had said publicly that my late mother was a Nazi collaborator. Dershowitz certainly has no problem about not just going into the street, but going deep into the sewer. And out of respect for my mother's memory, I had a lot of trouble deciding how to react to my friend's suggestion. Because I know my mother would have despised me if I didn't throttle the guy. And that too, I mean literally, throttle the guy. And here I was, my friend saying, why don't you invite him over? Well, my friend walked over to him and told him to come over to our table. And he did. He's an older man now. He was never what you would call Hollywood good looks. And age didn't serve him well. Very pasty complexion, yellowing teeth, the paunch. And it was, my own reaction was, he was so ordinary, so banal, I couldn't even manufacture any anger. He was like a garbage pail.
But you know,
it's hard to get angry at a garbage pail. And so it was that moment of what you might call epiphany.
Yeah.
Where I thought to myself, he's not the problem.
He's a symptom.
He's a symptom, but the problem is the enablers, not him.
Right. You know,
just one last example. You take someone like Michael Jackson. If you remember the Thriller album, when you opened up, he was a decent-looking young man. He was a decent. By the end, I mean, it was terrifying to look at his face.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Terrifying to look at his face. Not one plastic surgeon
yep.
had enough professional
courtesy.
Say again,
professionalism. Just yeah. professionalism. Not
professionalism to say, Michael, you don't need another cut.
No, there's always somebody who'll take your money and do what you want.
Exactly.
Them to
do. Each cut is $10,000.
Right.
Each cut is $10,000. So nobody will just say, Michael, you really don't need another cut. You really don't. You know?
It's
those people.
Yeah.
It's those people who fill me with loathing. It's not like Michael Jackson is a narcissist. Michael Jackson had serious mental problems. It was everybody who capitalized.
Exactly.
You know, and that's how I felt with Dershowitz. He was so banal.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I also think,
Norman,
I also think this comes full circle in a lot of ways for, I think, what is sort of this crumbling infrastructure within our political arena that we're seeing today. It isn't so much, I mean, obviously it is the people who are at the top, but there are so many enablers within the system who benefit from it.
Gravelers.
Sycophants.
We call them in politics, we call it the consultant class is what they like to be known as, even though their consulting can result in 10 consecutive losses, but it doesn't matter because, you know, they're part of a protected class. The last thing I want to hit on before we depart, Norman, you know, you and Jen obviously had really hammered the idea of what has changed in the last generation, which is this idea that we have come from Israel is benevolent to it is time to see dramatic change. Do you think there was one specific incident that we can point to where things really changed? I mean, I think that when Netanyahu came and spoke to Congress, and even after Obama said no, and he insulted the president of the United States in such a horrific way, and I'm not a big Obama supporter in any way, but well, I'm curious.
If you think
there was an incident, it's specifically
if I had time to elaborate, yes, I would definitely include that. because you just saw what a racist Netanyahu was.
Yeah.
It was pure racism. You ask yourself a simple question. If it were Bill Clinton who had been president, and Bill Clinton wanted to sign the Iran agreement, and it's perfectly plausible he would have wanted to sign the Iran agreement. And then Obama said, excuse me, and then Prime Minister Netanyahu said, I'm coming to your Congress. You can have no doubt that Bill Clinton would have picked up the phone, called Mr. Netanyahu's office, and said, hello, may I speak to Prime Minister Netanyahu? Hold on. Mr. Netanyahu gets on. Shalom, Bill. Bill says, Bibi, did I read correctly? You're coming to Congress? Really? What the fuck are you doing? You know?
He wouldn't have tolerated it. He wouldn't have tolerated it.
It couldn't have happened with a white guy.
Right.
I'm not one of those people who reduces everything to race.
Yeah.
But it's because Netanyahu is such a Jewish white supremacist.
He is so racist. He grew up
in Philadelphia. His father was like a bonkers racist. So it couldn't have happened had it been a white president. Do you think Jimmy Carter would have tolerated that?
No. Of course not.
Couldn't happen. So I totally agree with you. And as I said, if I had time, I would elaborate on your point. But I think your point's absolutely correct. That was a very critical moment. That's why Biden took many, 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 many days before he made his first call to Netanyahu. I think it took 2 weeks before he would even call him, because he was the vice president at the time. Right. And he didn't like, if you excuse my language, he didn't like that kind of shit.
Right. No. You
don't carry on with the president of the United States that way.
Yeah.
And again, we can't thank you enough for coming on. Obviously, this has been a very important conversation. We definitely would want to have you back for sure, because it's still too early to tell what's going to happen with Bennett now becoming the prime minister, and if that's going to change anything.
No.
It's probably not, but we... Again, is it?
It's sort of like the difference of Biden becoming president. Did that change anything?
No, not really. But is there a possibility of a positive change? Yes, there's also a possibility this could get worse. So it's still too early to tell. But like you said, there definitely has been a dramatic shift.
Yes.
In this conversation.
No, we have to look at different levels. There's the level of popular opinion and public opinion, and then there's the level of the political process. And one doesn't right away translate into another. You know, as Bernie Sanders pointed out ad infinitum, 80% of American people support single payer. So at the level of public opinion, you won the battle for single payer. But to translate that into a political victory, that's another battle. It's a very hard one to win. So I would say it's an important victory, the shift in public opinion. But it hasn't yet translated into something substantially political, although it is true to say that the so-called squad gave Biden a lot of trouble over his last support of Israel during the attack. So politically, you began to see things happen.
We're seeing it. We're working on it.
Yeah, everything is unfortunately a slow drip to some degree, but I think it's dripping in the right direction. And Norman, thank you so much for coming on. Again, Norman Finkelstein, check out his books, his most recent one, I Accuse, highly recommend. And of course, this is a very controversial topic, is Israel-Palestine, but one that must be addressed. And we thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.